I'm back and with a wise man from Bristol, otherwise known as Tony Gosling. Tony G, with Richie Allen with you till I don't know when. Tony Gosling is live in Bristol. Terrific reporter, writer and broadcaster, thisweek.org.uk. And I recommend you check out Tony's books. I always say I'll do this. I will do it. I'll do it before the week is out. I'll put a link to his books on the website because they're very, very, very good. And they're very prescient, Tony. Tony, prescient is a word that would get you a good Scrabble score, I reckon. What do you think?
I don't know. What does it mean?
Prescient means it's very relevant to the time we're in, basically. It's prescient. I looked it up
a
earlier
bit
on.
Prophetic.
Exactly. Tell me this. Jonathan Maitland has written in The Spectator, Scrabble is banning words. Lots and lots of words, like Jew, because...
Oh, come on.
No, serious stuff. This is tyranny, and people say we shouldn't talk about this stuff because it's not really that important, but it is very important.
It is, yeah.
Isn't it?
I mean, the idea of banning words is absolutely... I would suggest people quickly go and get a Scrabble dictionary now. This is what we use when we play, the family plays Scrabble. It's a big, thick Scrabble dictionary, which has got some quite interesting little bits and pieces about weird words that you can use in Scrabble, and also some stuff about why you can't use other words. But, you know, banning words, this is absolutely ridiculous. The idea is that you're trying to control thinking, really. This is thought crime, isn't it? You know, you think the word Jew. I mean, I actually had this from an old friend of mine, and I was pointing out I had a fantastic Jewish physics teacher in my A-levels at school, Dr. Martin Black, at the old Beckenham and Penge Grammar School in London, next door, by the way, to the Wellcome Trust, where they had all their research laboratories in London, which was a bizarre place to have my secondary school. But I pointed out that he was a fantastic physics teacher and Jewish, and he brought some of his Jewish faith into the teaching, which was brilliant. You know, for example, you know, he'd talk about certain things happening because God made it that way, you know, which is just not the sort of thing you expect these days in a physics lesson. But I was called out for doing that, saying, well, how dare you, draw attention to the fact that he's Jewish. Now, of course, you know, look, this is part of a major world religion, and the idea that you're not allowed to talk about it and the whole subject is taboo. This is from the South Sea Islands. This is where, you know, there are certain things you're not allowed to talk about, and also they're doing human sacrifice. And this is basically a superstitious way of running the world. And we're not living in that world anymore, thank God. And so, of course, you can use words, whichever words you want to use, so long as you're not breaking the law, in other words, inciting crime, you can say whatever you want.
100%, yeah. Context is important. My great friend, Jean Ann Crowley, journalist and actress in Dublin, in Connemara, I should say, today, made a very good point. You're not using the words for any reason when you're playing Scrabble. You are just, you're not using it. You're not saying the words. You're just saying, well, this is a word. I get so many points for that. It's crazy. There's so much we can get through. We have as much time as you want today. We normally do a half an hour, but we can do as much as you want to do.
You could play psychological warfare with your Scrabble opponents by using words which have some sort of hidden meaning, you know, or are an oblique sideswipe at their personality or something. I suppose you could do that.
You could do that. Let's start with a couple of minor things which bleed into bigger things. Isn't it interesting that Private Eye has gone with this story that, I know you talked about it back in 2018, but it went away, that Carrie Simmons, as she was then, was able to get the Times to back off the story. She was having an affair with Johnson when his marriage was breaking down, finally, when it was coming to the bitter end. He kept that affair secret from the Foreign Office staff and everybody else, but he was trying to get Carrie a gig, a six-figure gig, working for him in the Foreign Office. Now, this is high corruption, this. And the aides at the Foreign Office only learned that they were not, that Johnson and Carrie were not colleagues, but that they were something more serious when an MP walked in on her performing oral sex on him. So this has come up overnight, and some media outlets are going big on this today. I mean, this should bring him down. on its own. He tried to get some woman he was having an affair with a major job in the Foreign Office while keeping it a secret.
It sounds a bit like Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton, doesn't it?
A little bit like that, actually. I think somebody made that point on Twitter today. I would argue it's the least of his crimes. Would you? Really, in recent years?
Well, look, I mean, there's obviously a Get Boris, but I mean, the thing is, you've got to be quite scrupulous in who is going to take over. Once you know who at least stands a reasonable chance of taking over from Boris, it's fair game to, you know, chop his legs off, you know, whatever, get rid of the guy. But I think this is the problem I have with much of this coverage over the last couple of years is, there is an expectation that, oh, well, it's just going to be a kind of free-for-all and maybe Jeremy Hunt or somebody like that might come in. But, you know, I think we do need to be quite certain before you get rid of Boris that someone better might be taking his place. Otherwise, things could get far, far worse even, couldn't they?
Absolutely. Lovely comment from Ian on the website. Massive love for Tony and the BCFM, BCFM politics show, or not the BCFM politics
That's
show.
It.
Massive love for Tony, says Ian. Martin Summers too. Great stuff, he says. Good plug there. I second that. Hear, hear. From the chair here. Tony, there's so much to get into, right? What did Tesco do in the last 36 hours? They're having a row with one of the biggest wholesalers of food on planet Earth, or the biggest manufacturers, I should say.
Monopolists, yes, really. They're food chain monopolists. Kraft Foods, they are. I mean, although, you know, they own lots of different titles. I mean, I was just very struck yesterday afternoon listening to the bulletins talking about this, that the BBC were not making it clear, or not actually the other channel I listened to, I think it might have been the Talk Radio Bulletin, they weren't making it clear whether the prices that Tesco were charging were too low or too high. Well, a little bit of a reading into the story and digging into the story, and you can see that what Tesco were trying to do was to actually keep prices low, and it was Kraft Heinz that didn't want that, and so were saying, well, if you won't put your prices up the way we want you to, listen, the supermarkets, however evil and wicked they are in trying to control our food supply, you know, back from the world when I was growing up, you know, there'd be little greengrocers everywhere, farmers would supply them directly. And I mean, we had up until last year, the only major supermarket chain that was dealing directly with farmers and bringing in meat, etc., from those farms and putting them straight onto the shelves was Morrisons. And Morrisons got bought out by a private equity firm in the United States, a hostile takeover, after Mr. Morrison, whoever he was, died. And so they no longer do that. So the relationship is being in the process of being severed with the individual farms. What we're ending up with is a massive, massive food chains, monopolists controlling that. And I'm also very much aware of the, through the research I've done, which is in my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, which is really, I mean, the two books you mentioned at the start. I've got one, which is The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is a way of looking into all sorts. I mean, it's really an anthology from other people's work over the last 350 or so years since the English Civil War of secret government. So examples of secret government, quotes from the Illuminati, why it is that I think that the Illuminati is a serious Masonic organization that needs to be, you know, properly studied rather than laughed at and dismissed like Robert Anton Wilson was trying to get everyone to do. And so that's number one. But the other book, The Traitors of Arnhem, does look into this Fourth Reich. And one of the things I discovered looking into the Bilderbergers was that the looted wealth from Europe at the end of the Second World War was laundered through, I mean, we're talking about $1 billion here. In those days, money, that was an astronomical
major
figure.
Major money.
And through Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, and then secreted into these 750 companies, which were created by Hitler's disappeared private secretary, Martin Bormann, over in South America. I mean, he was basically a bureaucrat and a mafia guy. He didn't really believe in the Nazis any more than anyone else, but he saw it as an opportunity to make a lot of money. And he used the this laundered cash from the war, which the British helped him and the Americans helped him to launder, to put into these 750 firms. And I would point to Kraft as a perfect example of what may well be one of those companies. The idea was the firms were going to be monopolistic, transnational companies, and that they were going to use these as a kind of economic empire, if you want, funded by and supported by their own banks that they controlled. And if there was a bank they didn't control or a company, a food company they didn't control, they would do hostile takeovers. They'd take them out by fair means or foul, infiltrate the boards and all that sort of thing. So that's really what I'm describing in The Traitors of Arnhem, is the process by which we went from World War II and all this loot that the Nazis had taken from the whole of Europe to a new kind of fascism, an economic fascism. And even chatting to Dutch friends of mine, one guy I met over in Arnhem doing the talk, he was saying, well, like literally the 2 weeks after the end of the Second World War, we had Germans setting up businesses in Holland with money from we didn't know where, in limousines, you know, driving over here, very expensive cars. And we were thinking, well, the Germans are getting started rather quickly after the war, aren't they?
That's
and of course,
amazing.
Now, European business, economy and industry is generally dominated by the Germans.
Now, So to go back to what Tesco have done, it's being reported that Tesco is taking down or is taking Heinz products, Kraft Heinz products, off its shelves. That this is escalating this. This is a big deal because Tesco is probably, I don't know which of them does the most trade in the country. I don't know which of them is the most successful, but Tesco's got to be up there. Maybe Sainsbury's, I don't know. So it's a big deal for Tesco to say the manufacturer, Kraft Heinz, are trying to keep the price artificially high in the worst time that people have had to endure or go through for 40-odd years. We want to keep it affordable. You're not playing ball. We don't like it. You're bully boys, so we're going to take the products off the shelves. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And it's, in a way, it's a little bit like the run up to the English Civil War, because the Civil War, a lot of people would say, happened because of these monopolies growing up. And, you know, what's happening with big companies, massive international companies like Kraft, is that they've taken over large parts of the market, and they're now using that economic muscle to do what they call price fixing. It's a bit like what the oil cartels have been doing since last autumn in just jacking up the price of oil. When you look at the crude prices on the international markets, in fact, in some cases have even fallen, but they're increasing the price just simply because they can.
These are
monopolistic practices. The shareholders, by the way, love this because they're getting massive dividends from these. Okay, so in the oil industry's case, the government's put a windfall tax on that. But, you know, most industries are simply doing incredibly well because they've now become so big and powerful that they're stopping any new entry to the market. They've monopolized the markets and they can now basically set the price themselves. There isn't any real competition. And what Tesco are doing, I think, is pushing back against that and saying, well, actually, we can get our baked beans from somebody else, we are doing what we can to, and also, of course, Tesco getting a lot of positive publicity out of this, in order to work for our consumers and against you, Heinz, as a supplier. And you know, they're cutting a deal. You know, they're going down to the wire, and I would imagine in the next few days that Heinz Kraft will simply have to deal with Tesco's and submit, because if this goes on and on. And the publicity generated for Heinz and Kraft is very negative, and for Tesco's will be positive, as that, you know, they're bringing the prices down for the consumers, and more people will go through those doors.
Be interesting if Heinz Kraft or Kraft Heinz does blink first. Now, you mentioned a moment ago the oil companies doing the same thing as Kraft Heinz. You are right. That to me is counterintuitive. They must know, the bosses of the big oil companies, that there is a net zero agenda at play in the world at the moment. It's a net zero agenda, which I believe, personally, it's just my opinion, is going to basically destroy the global economy, lead to global unemployment and all the rest of it. The food chain and everything is going to be terrible, right? But by keeping oil high, prices high, which they are doing, and not, keeping them affordable, they're making it easier for the green lunatics to get people off the roads, aren't they? To get them accustomed to not being on the roads.
Well, look, I mean, I wouldn't call them green lunatics, although I think there are some fanatical greens who seem to delight in the fact that everybody is having to pay more to get around. They're thinking, oh, we're going to get them to persuade them to all buy scooters to go to work on these little electric scooters or something. But what they don't understand, Richie, is that because of the increase in the global price of oil, what's happening is more and more countries, not necessarily here, but particularly in the developing world, are looking at their various choices as to where to get their energy from. They really don't take much notice of this whole, sort of COP26, Prince Charles, Klaus Schwab agenda. And Bill Gates as well, by the way, is involved in all of that. And what they're doing is they're starting to buy more coal and they're starting to use more coal to generate power. And also the coal price is becoming, you know, more lucrative and more sensible. And so quite a lot of consumers, particularly industries in the developing world, are using more and more coal. So as these, fanatics, green, you know, the sort of decarbonizers, you know, and I do wonder when people talk about decarbonization, like our mayor, Marvin Rees, here in Bristol, maybe he should be the first to decarbonize because he's made of carbon. You know, basically, what is going on? You can't just decarbonize. Carbon is the stuff of life. And the idea that, you know, you're going to bring in a new kind of great reset with carbon credits as the new kind of currency, and people are going to be judged on what, you know, what they do and what they don't. Consume in terms of carbon. I just don't believe that people are going to buy into all of this, Richie. I think quite a lot have, but at the end of the day, the oil companies will just simply, I think, you know, they're part of this. They can see that there's all sorts of potential problems with the Middle East, potential wars around the world that might restrict the supply of oil. So they're preparing for a different kind of energy market. And I would much rather that they spent their time and effort on, not necessarily punishing car users, but by making a decent public transport, like there was when I was a kid in the late 1960s, early 70s. We had a fantastic bus services. We had, you know, a bus would come along every 6 minutes or something, and extremely, extremely efficient, quick and cheap, supplied at cost, rail services everywhere. So you wanted to get around the country, you could do it quickly and efficiently, a nice comfy seat, a restaurant car if you wanted to eat something on your trip to Manchester or wherever it was you were going. Plenty of staff around, a nice ticket office where you could speak to somebody about what kind of ticket you wanted and where you were going to come back, and without having to negotiate some sort of computer game in order to buy yourself a simple rail ticket to Edinburgh, which was going to cost you 10 times what the flight would.
Yeah, these are not the days to be a senior person trying to navigate this type of thing. I'm 47 and I struggle myself. I can only imagine if someone 20 years older than me is trying to buy a ticket on a train. Yeah, I buy most of that. Of course I support the strikes. Of course, as an old socialist, I believe we should nationalise everything. It should be run by the state for the people. I agree with all of that. Tony Gosling is our guest, thisweek.org.uk, bilderberg.org. Let's talk about the future king who, somebody very close to me doesn't believe will ever take the throne. We might come back to that. He received a briefcase full of cash from a Saudi prince, £1 million was in it. I despise the man, but here's the but, there's a big but here. He banked the money, every penny of it was accounted for, and it's being distributed through his foundation. So what's the problem?
Look, the main problem with all of this is, first of all, this should not be a cash transaction. He's quite obviously done the cash transaction to try and avoid scrutiny by the authorities. You know, millions of pounds going into charitable bank accounts from a specific individual. If it's cash, it can't be traced. Now, this is the way the mafia operates. This is the way gangsters operate. I always remember looking at the Mexico situation with the drug cartels there. The branches of HSBC Bank in Mexico were all equipped with this special counter where you could put a whole suitcase of money through the counter at the end of the counter. There was a hatch. That's what Prince Charles is basically dealing with at Coutts Bank. And not only that, the woman who has now taken over from Fawcett, who was sacked as his aide on this charity, when this was originally came out, I think it was end of last year, actually. Was it the beginning of this year? share this story. She was actually directly involved in this crookery and money laundering is all I can call it. Because, you know, what he's doing is he's trying to conceal where the money's come from. That's the only reason you would use to use massive amounts of cash. They can easily do a little bank transfer, but they wanted to conceal that. And the idea of that this is going to some charity. Well, these charities, as we know, with Bill Gates, etc., these foundations that are set up, these trust funds that are set up under the charitable status, are simply used for their own political benefit. And it's a way to say, well, I'm doing a great thing, I'm doing something wonderful, but of course you are the one who's appointing all the people to that so-called wonderful. I mean, one of the things, for example, that this money was used for was the restoration of one of Charles's palaces up in Scotland, a large house. Well, you can call it a palace. It's an enormous house up in Scotland. I think it's in Dumfries somewhere. So he's basically using this to supplement his income from the Duchy of Cornwall estate. And I noticed yesterday, I think it's Rob Evans at The Guardian, had another story on Prince Charles altering the law to suit himself. And this is back in the 1990s. It's only just come out through the release of documents, so like a kind of 30-year rule, that Prince Charles altered a law which had been passed by the House of Commons and House of Lords at third reading. Before it went into law, Prince Charles made a few adjustments. So
you mean he lobbied?
Duchy of Cornwall estate wouldn't have to pay or wouldn't have to, I think it's to do with leaseholders, so that he would not have to offer his leaseholders in Newton St. Low, which is a little village here near between Bristol and Bath, the opportunity to buy their own places. So this had gone through in the 1990s as a law for everybody else, but Prince Charles wrote in a clause accepting himself from that process. And of course those people who live in that village are now massively financially worse off potentially than they would have been if he hadn't done that. So this is an abuse of power, Richie. This is not, you know, Prince Charles is not there to write the law. That's what Parliament does.
No, but how did he get away with that?
Alter it.
Hang on to you. How did he get away with that? Are you saying that he lobbied members of the House of Lords to amend the bill?
No, this is, well, okay, so this is before an Act of Parliament, or a bill becomes an Act of Parliament and receives the royal assent, and there is this little known period of time of a week or so between it being about to get the royal assent and actually the royal family, or it would be the Queen signing it, that the royal family get a chance to scrutinise it and then alter it if it affects their estates, if they wish to. And Charles had done this secretly without telling anybody so that he could financially benefit from the people living in this village. I can't remember exactly the term that Rob Evans uses in The Guardian, but I noticed that story yesterday. I mean, all those people living in that village now will be looking at it and thinking, oh, well, that's funny, isn't it? Because, you know, we could possibly have been able to own our own homes now if it hadn't been for Prince Charles forcing us to be tenants for life rather than giving us the opportunity to buy the houses we've lived in for generations.
That is really, really interesting, that. I wasn't aware of that. Tony Gosling is our guest. That's why he's our guest. He looks into this stuff. You think he is? Look, I don't want to be putting words in your mouth. I don't want to be tabloid. I don't like tabloids. But I get the feeling you think the guy is evil incarnate. Do you, Charles?
No, not, I wouldn't say evil incarnate, but he's an opportunist. He's somebody who's he sees his position as you know, some kind of potential for him to use that office for himself. He's certainly not selfless. I can remember, actually, there was a piece, I think it was in 2020, in the Daily Express, which articulated a lot of stuff which people have been suspicious about back in, I think it was around about 2013, when Charles and Camilla got married and the Queen didn't turn up at the wedding. It was a civil ceremony. And the article's entitled, the Queen is saying that the church is more important than Charles. So she didn't turn up at the wedding because actually what had happened is Charles had been divorced from Diana, but it was him that was responsible for it. So in law, in the actual law, the royal family are not allowed to do that and then get remarried. So if she divorces him for something that he's done, he's no longer, he would not be allowed to get remarried. And so that's why the Queen stood away from that. I think they're very different characters, the Queen and him, and that she's someone that genuinely sees herself as somebody that is there to serve the public. I know she's she's extremely wealthy, and she could probably share her wealth around a lot more. But Charles, I think, sees this as an opportunity simply to make money for himself. And also, this is one of the reasons I think he's been involved with Schwab and the rest of them in setting up this new carbon credit system and personally benefiting from it himself, hoping that if and when the world economy crashes, the IMF system and the, you know, the normal banking system we've got in the West crashes, that this, the system that replaces it, he will be personally profiting from it. And I think he's, you know, he's basically selfish, whereas, and he thinks he can use his public relations team to protect his image. Whereas the Queen, I think, is much more genuine. And he, of course, has got weighed into lots of these political things, like, for example, this business about sending people to Rwanda. You know, as he starts to weigh in on questions like that, for, you know, he also said that he thinks Vladimir Putin is behaving like Adolf Hitler. You know, things like this the Queen would never say, because she realizes that that would compromise her ambassadors around the world. It would make it very difficult, for example, to make peace with countries that have been criticized by their head of state, much more difficult. So she doesn't muddy the waters in that way, and she keeps mum on it in a way. Whereas I think he's, you know, he wants to be on the political stage in the whole, in the world, and he can't really stop himself from saying what he really thinks, which is often, you know, particularly problematic, you know, for many people who, for example, they want something done about the flood. I mean, I was a couple of days ago was down in Folkestone. You can see France, and you're looking at over at you know, the other side of the channel, and you think, well, that's not actually, doesn't look very far for these migrants to come, you know. But we do need to control our borders. If you're going to be a sovereign country, you can't just allow the mafia to smuggle in you know, cheap migrant labor into your country willy-nilly. And these are the sort of people that the RMT are striking, to say, well, look, we don't want cheap migrant untrained labor taking over in the you know, repairing our railway tracks, etc. What we want is people in with good job security, good pay, good training. It doesn't matter where in the world they come from, but this cheap migrant labor has been used to undermine pay and conditions right across the country in all sorts of industries.
It always has. Tony Blair is evil incarnate. He is one of the most demonstrably evil human beings ever to walk the face of the earth. And yet your cuddly little great-grandmother in Buckingham Palace gave him the Order of the Garter. Now, listen, hang on. Now, you've had a good say now. Before you go down this road of it's, you know, there's a structure at the palace and she's advised and she's told you've got to give this to that guy and this to that guy, I'm not buying that. The Queen is fully aware that Tony Blair is an evil madman. Nobody who is genuine or decent would come anywhere near him, let alone give him an award like that. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would agree with you. I mean, I find it very difficult to, it's impossible to justify, isn't it, that somebody like that might. But it may be that, you know, she is part of the 24 Garter Knights. I think that's right, or 26 Garter Knights. This is part of this investigation I've just done the last Friday into the English Civil War and looking at the origins of the Order of the Garter. It's inexcusable that Blair should be given this award in this way. Of course, the guy should be in jail, as I think should be the people who have been prosecuting Julian Assange for perversion of the course of justice, for war crimes or whatever. When we're seeing criminals now let off completely and walking the streets, and some of them are actually sitting in the judge's seat in our courtrooms, in my opinion. And so no excuse for that. But I think we need to look at what the Garter, Order of the Garter is. It's this two groups of 13 knights, which some have pointed out, like Margaret Murray. She was a writer in the 1920s and 1930s on witchcraft. Her book was called The Witch Cult in Western Europe. She's pointed out that the Garter is the symbol of the high priestess or high priest in a witchcraft coven, that they can reveal it, you know, they can show it to somebody if they want to reveal that they're actually a high priestess of a coven. And so I think that this use of the word the Order of the Garter does suggest that this organization, which was started 25 years after the destruction of the Knights Templar back in the 14th century, was maybe connected with the Templars and the witchcraft that the Templars were accused of. And so, you know, this organization, I think, is basically there to control the crown. So it includes the monarch, it includes the heir to the throne, In this case, here in Britain, it also includes the heir to the throne. That's William II. But they're surrounded by a whole bunch of, you know, people who I think have a great deal of power and a great deal of sway over the direction of the country. And maybe it's just that that Blair was included on the list at their recommendation to the Queen. And also, I think I'm feeling a bit sorry for her at the moment. I think she's pretty frail, pretty fragile. She may be finding it difficult to think straight and looking a little bit wobbly on her feet. So, and after all, of course, she may well have had the vaccine. And of course, that didn't.
I doubt it very much, T.
You doubt it? Why?
I doubt it. Because the well, if anything was stuck into her arm, it would most likely have been a placebo. The vaccines are killing people. They're killing lots of people.
Well, yes, they are. But you see, if she's not in on the whole thing, she may be become a victim of the, just as many other people, hundreds of thousands of other people around the world have become a victim of this. You know, I think, you know, this is the way these things work. Plots like this, those who are in the know are in the know. Those who are not in the know are not in the know. And it may well be the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh were not in the know. And they thought, well, we better go along with
this. Let me read a few comments. Hang on.
It's a very powerful psychological operation going on, you know.
Hang on. Tony Gosling is our guest this week. org.uk Fridays 5 o'clock, not the BCFM politics show, is an outstanding listen, so listen to it if you haven't before. I'm going to read these comments. Don't jump in or I'll beat the bejesus out of you. From here I have special powers. As soon as I read the last comment, come right back in. Chris asks, Charles is a direct descendant of Vlad the Impaler, right? He asks, lives a lot of time in Romania, does he? A Romanian friend says that the locals generally like him there. We'll come back to that. Peggy says, who cares about the biggest benefit stealing Germans? They're part of the black nobility. Well said, Peggy. Neil says, Tony has got his Queen rose tinted glasses on again. The Queen's for the people, says Neil. Yeah, right. And then Chris asks, is old Jug Ears head of the Great Reset in the UK? Which of those would you like to get into?
Well, I don't think she's kind of 100% rooting for the people, the Queen, but I do think she takes her responsibilities to the public much more seriously and understands them much more than Charles. I mean, if you remember, she was brought up during the Second World War, wasn't she? And she saw the bombing. I don't think she was necessarily in any way in on the shenanigans behind the Second World War. In other words, the Wall Street and the City of London helping fund Hitler as a buttress against the Soviet Union. You know, they saw it as a, you know, war of good, as a good against evil, I think, most of young people in those days. And, you know, seeing the Blitz of London, she probably wouldn't have been aware that it was her uncle, Edward VIII, who over in Lisbon in 1940 actually persuaded Hitler's ambassador to start bombing Britain. You know, she wouldn't have been in on those things. And I just think that she's got this, you know, she's got a more... Should we say, public-spirited side to her. I'm not saying that she's going to shower her wealth around to everybody, but, you know, this is all, it's all by degrees in the aristocracy. And I think, you know, Charles is the consummate, you know, sneaky, Machiavellian, selfish person. I mean, I also think that he was complicit with the murder of his wife, Princess Diana. I think that's pretty clear if you look at the John Morgan's books and the Paget Report and all that stuff to do with the actual evidence through the courts. And also, of course, the Keith Allen's documentary about the death of Princess Diana. Or unlawful killing, I think it was called.
That's right.
Lots of evidence that she was, you know, killed by the secret state. I think the guy's name who went over to actually conduct the operation, he was a Bilderberger. Can't remember his name off the top of my head, but anyway, he went over to take over MI6. This guy, I think, wants to, you know, it's a kind of despotic, potentially anyway, despotic ruler and in waiting. And it may well have been him that's nominated Blair, for example, especially as you've got, you know, these two groups of 13 in the Order of the Garter. It may be that the Queen gets to nominate one and Charles another. And it may well have been Charles that nominated Blair, not the Queen. We don't know. I don't know. There's lots of questions there, Richie, but I'm quite happy to answer anything you want.
Very good. No, it's good devil's advocate stuff. I like it. The Edward VIII stuff, encouraging the Nazis to bomb the UK, that's good. That there was a Channel 4 documentary, wasn't there, not long ago, which dealt with that. Very interesting stuff. That would have come.
Karina Erbach is the German historian that's dug out all the evidence of that, of the intelligence reports. And what he was basically saying was, if you want the British to negotiate, you're going to have to start bombing them. You know, that was his attitude. And I also spoke to Harry Beckhoff, who was an MI6 officer, who some of his colleagues in MI6 in World War II actually had to arrest Edward VIII because he was trying to cross in a limousine over into enemy lines, over into Nazi Germany. He'd come to some sort of arrangement where he could drive away from the British, cross over into Nazi-occupied Europe, and then he would have, you know, this is amazing stuff, because he was very sympathetic with the Nazis. And I think there were factions that were at the time.
As was Prince Philip. He liked a Nazi or two too, didn't he? And
I don't think he was quite the same as a fanatic. I think he did a lot of joking around, Philip. And he had a difficult position, didn't he? Because he was always playing second fiddle. He had to stand there like a lemon as the Queen did her stuff. And he cracked some jokes. Actually, some of them actually made me laugh.
But he went to funerals of Nazi officers. His sisters married Nazi officers.
This is during, they were his relatives.
Yeah, but he knew what they were doing. He was fully aware of what they were doing. He knew what was going on in Germany in the 1930s. He knew the propaganda war against Jewish people. He knew what was going on in the ghettos, didn't he? He knew this stuff. He must have.
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
I think once he saw the way the war was going, you know, it seems to me that he didn't, you know, he decided which side he was on, joined the Royal Navy, etc. And, the thing is, lots of people were sucked in the 1930s into what Hitler was doing. In fact, the whole Steiner movement, Rudolf Steiner and people like that were very enthusiastic about Hitler. They said he's doing a great job, until they realised that, you know, what was actually happening. Because this is what I think may be going to happen in the future again, Richie, which is the economy is deliberately crashed as it was in Germany, and the Nazis ride to power on the back of that. So, you know, Hitler is made to look like a hero for sorting out the economy. We could see a similar kind of thing happening in the West in the future. If the economy goes down the tubes, as it looks like it might well do almost at any point, you know, they can pull the plug on the economy now. And then somebody arrives on the world scene, on the European scene or wherever, as a superhero to sort everything out, and everyone thinks they're great. Well, this is the way these people get their cachet, political cachet, and then they stick the knife in, as Hitler did.
Would you believe it? This second, I've just had a message from Clarence House, the royal residence in London, England. Would you believe that? I'm told to tell you, this is just signed HRH, to tell Tony Gosling that when you get home tonight, there'll be a third story on your house. Well done for putting the firm's side of things to the Richie Allen Show.
Oh,
listeners.
Really?
Fantastic. Tony Gosling is our guest, thisweek.org.uk. Let's finish with NATO, and we'll, as always, make room for a bit of plugging for the books of the boy Gosling. We have to support the independent media folks, especially when it's brilliant. Got to do that. Look, NATO, 300,000 troops in Finland and Sweden and all of this. I know nothing is black and white. There are no absolutes, but people are genuinely worried that we're edging towards a conflict that is not proxy wars in other countries and isn't drone wars, but something, you know, something far more deadly. How do you read this?
Well, it is deadly serious, isn't it? This is actually now in Europe. It's a similar kind of tactic that the Russians and the Syrian Arab Army were using in Syria to clear ISIS out, is now being used in the Donbass region in Ukraine to clear out the Azov battalion and the... Well, I mean, I think the main problem over in Ukraine is that you've got... You know, Nazis, effectively, I mean, Bandera supporters in the senior officer positions in the intelligence services and in the armed forces. And these are very, very difficult to winkle out. You know, so the soldiers are doing the fighting. Many of the officers are not risking their necks. And so the Russians are really going to have to get rid of. I mean, the basic timeline there Obviously, there was the coup in 2014 with Victoria Nuland and the rest of them. And then there was this constant shelling of the breakaway regions, the Donbass and, you know, Donetsk and Lugansk. And then we got the Russians. It was the Munich Security Conference, Munich being the place where the Nazi Party was founded. The Munich Security Conference in February saying that, Zelensky thinks that the Ukraine should get its nuclear weapons back. Now, this is a red rag to the bull to the Russians, obviously, or to the bear. And they decided, right, well, rather than allow them to do their offensive, which they had intelligence was planned in March, I think it was March the 8th, to start a serious assault by the Ukrainian army on the Donbass region, they said, well, we're going to go in behind them and we're going to preempt that assault by, you know, starting to kick them out of the whole of the Donbass region. That's the two provinces, Lugansk and Donetsk. And they've nearly kicked all of the Ukrainians out of Lugansk now. Yeah. So I think personally, I think that's what the Russians want. I think what NATO wants is a war out of this, because they are an organization really without a purpose. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, what they've managed to do is convince the public through the press, the stupid people that is, that this is all the Russians' instigation. We're actually, I called up Talk Radio to discuss this with Mike Graham, who was actually prepared to listen to it the week before last, or possibly last week, actually. And it's to explain that Putin has been the one who's been holding back the Russian army and the Russian political system from actually going into Donetsk ever since 2014. At the time the coup happened and the conflict was going on and raging in the Donbass region, in this breakaway area, there were a lot of people saying to Putin, you've got to go in and defend these Russian-speaking people. And he was saying, no, let's not do this, let's not do it. And he's waited for 8 years, and by waiting for 8 years, he's now got even more of the Russian people behind him and the Russian Duma behind him, their parliament. So, I mean, we're getting a very different picture over here in our media.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, Putin has absolutely solidified the Russian people behind what he's doing by waiting so long before sending the army in. And it looks to me as if maybe by the end of the year, both of these two regions, one which is now finished, what is it, February, March, April, May, June, in 4 months, the Lugansk region has been taken. Maybe by the end of the year, the Russians would have retaken the whole of Donetsk as well, at which case there's a chance of making peace. I would like to see, rather than more weapons being poured into there, some sort of a negotiation now to end this as soon as possible, and to give the Russians some sort of guarantee of security, because they simply cannot have these Nazi units, the Azov, etc., and the NATO weapons pouring into Ukraine is, you know, right next to their border would have been absolutely horrific. So one can totally understand what they've done. What the way he's justified it, Putin, to himself and to the rest of the world, if anyone is actually listening, is that this was becoming an existential threat to Russia, and we're not going to put up with that. We put up with this back in 1939, 1940, 1941, and look where it got us. So we're not going to allow that to happen again. And so you can understand that the Russians want to make sure that they've got some sort of, you know, secure future rather than having their state threatened by the globalists. And that's really who is after them, the Anglo-Zionist empire, the globalists.
Right, Tony, that's brilliant stuff. We've got about 45 seconds left. We always do this, folks. I want you to support Tony Gosling. I want you to support his work. Listen to the show Fridays at 5 o'clock this week, .org.uk. It's a brilliantly professionally produced radio program. There aren't very many of them around. In fact, there's only two in the independent media in this country. There is only two.
Well, you used to call me the last man standing, didn't you? Until I got booted off of FM by the schoolmate.
Right. You were the last man standing. Yeah. You were. Give a quick plug. Where can people buy The Traitors of Arnhem and your other books? Go on.
Well, I I've also got to mention holding the line, and particularly Henry Widders, who I did an interview with earlier this week. And this is this group of journalists who are so disgusted with the biased coverage of COVID, and particularly, you know, people like Anna Breeze, etc., who've done a lot of work on the exposing some of the truth behind what's going on. Independent journalists around the country, there are many of them, and that's just two. But I did an interview with Henry yesterday. Looking at, you know, this from a journalistic point of view more than anything else, and you know, what is going on within the profession and the structure of the profession to allow something so horrific to happen, and also, I suppose, trying to big up some individuals who've done a good job and within the mainstream media. As Henry's a staff journalist, so my investigations, as I mentioned there, into Arnhem and Bilderberg, that's the Traitors of Arnhem. You can get that as a paperback or as a PDF through the Bilderberg.org website. And the other book, which is The Siege of Heaven Reader, is the one that is the anthology that looks through. I mean, it's a long book, it's about 300 pages, but it's all sorts of stuff in there from history, exposing the secret government, really, the government from behind the scenes. So, I mean, another one of my investigations, Richie, was into the beaching cuts back in the 1960s, looking at the fact that the oil industry was behind all that. And my most recent investigation, which was on Friday, is on another website, which is The Land Is Ours. That's tlio.org.uk. That looks at the English Civil War and how that was really all about empire and Freemasonry, and you know, the emergence of Freemasonry after the English Civil War. Actually, what was going on was the Masons were very much involved with Cromwell and getting rid of the king, because the king, what he'd been doing is stopping the British Empire, which was basically a clandestine operation started by John Dee under Elizabeth I. And as the empire was starting to roll out, Charles I stopped many of the things to do with the empire, and they said they realised that we're going to have to get rid of him. So the main website for the books is just simply bilderberg.org, and you can get both of them on eBay. The Siege of Heaven Reader and the Traitors of Arnhem, Richie.
Sounds good. I've got to do this, and I don't like doing it. I've never done it before, but I've got to retort to the Anna Breeze thing. Anna Breeze is not a journalist, Tony. Number one, Anna Breeze has engaged in contacting scientists and doctors and telling them not to appear on the Richie Allen Show, a radio show, which averages 170,000 listeners to the live stream and gets nearly 5 million downloads a month on Podomatic. That's Anna Breeze. She's not a
journalist.
Well, I know.
I think she's basically, she's a lunatic, sees herself as also doing some kind of freelance, you know, voluntary PR work in advising people not to go on this show, on that show. And I think she's very ill-advised to be doing that sort of thing. I also see that she was advising early on in the pandemic, she was advising Mike Yeadon not to go on the Piers Morgan morning show on ITV, yeah, which I think was a very bad idea, because, you know, he was absolutely, I think it would have been good in the early days of the pandemic to see Mike Yeadon on national television. It could have actually, you know, set the stage for a very early nixing of some of the lies that were being told, and I think Mike Yeadon would have been up to the job. And it's probably not a good idea for her to have persuaded him not to go on, if that's what she did.
Yeah, I've never heard of anything like that. I mean, first of all, she isn't a journalist. She's grossly exaggerated the work she did for ITV and the BBC. She did very little in reality, and she isn't qualified to teach journalism or anything else. But I've never heard of somebody in the media contacting potential guests and advising them not to speak to somebody. I've been doing this for 8 years independently. I have never bragged about the reach of this programme, but the reach of this programme is unbelievable. It's unprecedented. Well, like, why would you do that? Is it jealousy? I think the woman is mad. But anyway, it'll be the last I ever speak of her. I had to do it, T, because you mentioned her on my program.
No, that's fine. No good.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we just have to understand that some people, I mean, I think,
are fucking crazy.
When you say she's not a journalist, I think she is.
She's no qualifications.
Been doing some very useful interviews as well. Yeah. But I don't think it's a very wise thing for anybody to be intervening or warning people off interviewing somebody without a very good reason, which she certainly didn't have with you.
Well, no, she didn't. But anyway, listen, brilliant stuff as usual. 5 o'clock Friday, thisweek.org.uk, not the BCFM politics show. You've been listening to Tony Gosling. Brilliant, T. Thanks a lot, pal. And speak real soon.
Thank you. Cheers, Richie. God
bye,
bless.
Bye for now. Tony Gosling live on the line from Bristol. The time is 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Some things just have to be said, you know. 20 years in the business, I've never contacted somebody and told them not to appear on another show. You have to be mad or just insanely jealous, I think, to do that. I think it's the latter. Anyway, we'll never mention her again. She's a nutcase. This is Santana, Oye Como Va. I'm Richie Allen, the BBG. You're listening to the world's most listened to independent news radio show. There's nothing like it. Santana and Oye Como Va on your Richie Allen show.
Ask not what the BBG can do for you, but what you can do for the BBG. Support the Richie Allen show now at richieallen.co.uk.
Big rebuild next week. I meant to say this. It's not going to interfere too much with the live shows. Not too much. Maybe a day. But the studio's being kitted out with a lot of new equipment, including a broadcast mixer, a brand new one that's all bells and whistles. I opened the program. We talked about, you know, how long I've been doing this show and the madness of doing it here and kind of how special that is. It just dawned on me today. And I've asked for your support for 8 years. The show doesn't get any advertising, not regularly. We did have a little bit. Data Clinic and the wonderful Chris and others who I could mention off the top of my head from time to time. But largely over the course of the 8 years, it doesn't get any advertising, despite the success of it. And maybe it's in spite of the success of it. Maybe it's because of the success. I don't know. But it's difficult. It's because it spreads out, you see. The show, the listeners to this program are not narrowed down to a city or to a county. If it were, it'd be much easier, I suppose, to sell advertising, but the fact is it isn't. It's listened to in around about 113 countries around the world at the moment. That's according to the streaming statistics, which absolutely blow the minds of people like Hayden Hewitt and Paul Ripley. And that's a great thing, but a problem as well. It's been you, really. You've every month sent a couple of quid to the programme. Some people over the years have sent more than that. And once or twice over the years, some people have sent much more than that. What I've always done is pumped it right back into the programme. I've never done anything else really other than pump it back into the programme and increase the reach of it through spending much more money with the streaming company as I do year on year, year in, year out. But I'm taking possession of a broadcast mixer on Tuesday, I think, next week. It's an amazing bit of kit, it really is. That takes it to another level altogether, really. And I'm really looking forward to that. It'll have to be installed. The whole thing will have to be done again. New computers as well, a new playout system. That's next week. Paul, the legend Ripley from Fab Radio, is going to do it with me. It might be over Thursday and Friday next week. I'm not sure how it's going to work out. It can't be over the weekend. That's down to Paul. It's got to be during the week. It's got to be a weekday thing. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'll obviously upload photographs and stuff when it's all done. It'll be something a bit special, I think. So that's next week. Yeah, a new broadcast mixer, a new radio desk. I can't wait. The one I've got is wonderful, but this is next level stuff.